Hey, it's 5 o'clock. It's time for the Cable Evening News. I'm Lisa Loving. I'm the Evening News Director. And we are going to be a little bit off format tonight. First up, we've got a Free Speech Radio News special on the end of charity. Charity Hospital in New Orleans was one of the most used indigent hospitals, as they say, hospitals for poor people in the nation, and it looks like it's not going to be rebuilt after the hurricane. At roughly 5:30, I'm going to get on the air with Michael Papadopoulos. He's our news and information guru out of the Corvallis, Salem area. We're going to talk about some of the top stories of the year live. And just before 6 o'clock, we're going to have independent Native news. And then we're going to have Labor Radio, special by WBAI in New York about the aftermath of the transit strike. And then we're going to have a live interview about health insurance. 501, this song, I just got to let this song play out. This is dedicated to Eduardo de la Nerociere. Eduardo, don't let them get you down, okay, man?
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, December 26, 2005. The impacts of Hurricane Katrina in the Gulf South were many and varied, lesser known than the large number of refugees and the stories of rooftop rescues. Is that the hurricane affected many public services that were already in danger, such as schools and hospitals. Chief among these is New Orleans Charity Hospital, part of a system of free medical care for the poor in Louisiana that was unique in the United States. FSRN brings you the end of charity. I'm Aura Bogado. Please stay with us. New Orleans Charity Hospital was a source of often intense pride for those who worked there, as well as those it served, who received a quality of care that was in many ways of the highest quality, despite having been the lowest priority for funding for many years. Charity Hospital was damaged by Katrina and is in danger of not being rebuilt, denying the entire population the ability to get medical care when they need it. FSRN's Christian Roseland brings us the story of charity and what it meant to the people who worked and received care there.
Coming into New Orleans from the west on the freeway, right after taking the overpass where Interstate 10 takes a sharp left before the Mississippi River Bridge, rising above the medium-sized office buildings is a stained concrete shell 18 stories high, which appears to be decades older than its peers. From the ground on Tulane Avenue, it is a looming edifice with many boarded-up windows in its two wide wings. But besides the telltale brown lines left by receding floodwater, there is little to indicate what took place here in the agonizing days after Hurricane Katrina, which are only the latest among the many difficult memories that the Avery C. Alexander Medical Center of Louisiana has held. On the streets of New Orleans, this building has another name: Charity. Big charity to the rest of Louisiana. The story of charity is many things. The story of an institution, the story of a building, the story of a way of practicing and thinking about medicine. But more than anything, the story of Charity Hospital is the story of the people for whom that building is the first and the last thing they see in this world, the place where life begins and ends.
Tiki Black, my name is Angela Woods, a.k.a. Tiki Black. I'm from the Night Walk, Lower Night Walk. Born on Charbonnet, born in Charity Hospital. 1975, my year, my claim of fame. You understand what I'm talking about?
Rapper Tiki Black is one of the many thousands of New Orleanians born in Charity Hospital, whose ranks include politicians, professors, and doctors, as well as rap stars, nurses, and mothers, of which Black is all three. Tiki Black trained at Charity Hospital School of Nursing, and like many here, she has an intimate relationship with the hospital. Charity was a level one trauma facility and took care of the worst injuries, mostly car crashes, but also the stabbings and gunshot wounds that are a fact of life in the sometime murder capital of the nation. It is taken for granted here that when you're in a life-threatening situation, Charity is where you want to go, and it is where Black brought an ex-boyfriend who had been shot.
A guy that I was dating had got shot in his arm, and he came to my house, you know what I'm saying? Then I drove him to Charity, and at that time, you know, it was his first shot wound, so he was, like, passing out and things like that. But once he got into the trauma area and into the hospital, they took care of him.
Everyone in New Orleans seems to have a story about Charity Hospital. Some are humorous, others painful, and some are not spoken of but become part of the collective memory of the building. Carolyn Bauman has lived in New Orleans her entire life, and generations of her family have gone to Charity for care. She tells the story of when her grandmother went there for surgery.
Back in 78, 79, somewhere thereabouts, and she felt a lump in her breast. And she got on the bus, packed a little bag, and got on the bus and drove and went to Charity Hospital and told them she came in for them to cut her titty off. So they obliged her. That was before they started doing testing to see, you know, if the lump was malignant or whatever. So they cut it off, and she stayed there at Charity for about 4 days. And she kept telling them she had to come back home because she had a 17-room house at 3131 Pine Street, on Pine Street in Gertown. And so she kept saying she had to go back and take care of her house. And they said, oh, no, so you're too old. We have to keep you here to check you, you know, make sure that you can handle it and you all right. So the end of that week, she got tired talking to him about it, so she packed a little bundle again. She went downstairs, got on the bus, and went back to her house. That's after she'd had that operation.
Bauman says the care that Charity provided was crucial for the largest population in the city.
Charity has really been a marvelous place for Black people, especially poor Black people, to go to. They've had the finest doctors there. And a lot of interns were really just testing on the patients there, but they still had very good doctors there, best doctors.
Charity Hospital as an institution began in the early 18th century, when a merchant seaman included a sizable sum of money as well for medical care for the poor. While the methods of that care, the technology used, even the buildings themselves have changed dramatically over the centuries, that mission, caring for those in poverty, has not. Central to this mission was the passing, in 1926, of the Open Access Law for Louisiana, guaranteeing medical care for those described as indigent. Until it was modified a few years ago, Louisiana was the only state in the nation with such a guarantee. The building on Tulane Avenue began in 1939 when Sister Stanislaus, one of the Sisters of Charity, an order of nuns who care for the sick and the poor, asked President Roosevelt for funds to build a new facility to replace the seriously outdated building that Charity was operating out of at the time. The massive facility, completed in 1941, along with University Hospital across the street, has been where hundreds of thousands in New Orleans, without access to insurance, have gone for medical care. Over the years, the care that Charity provided became legendary. Ben Dubois Blanc, medical director at Charity New Orleans, has worked there since 1977.
It's one of those places that was steeped in tradition. There's only a half dozen hospitals around the country that are recognizable by name. Charity, Bellevue, Cook County.
And for new doctors, walking into the halls of Charity could be a harrowing experience.
My name is Renee Morrissey. I work at Charity Hospital, where I've been for 4.5 years.
Renee Morrissey moved to New Orleans to train at Charity Hospital and recalls his first day at work.
It was a Sunday. It was actually only half a day. But I do remember being at home and sitting on my porch and my neighbors, whom I just recently met, pulling up and seeing me as they describe it now, with a tub of melted ice cream, half eaten, between my knees, sitting on the porch, just staring off in the distance. And I was working in the accident room, which is the trauma bays where all the trauma patients come. I'd seen 5 penetrating traumas, which means people shot or stabbed. And also, if I remember correctly, a woman who had been beaten in the head with a brick at a family dinner. And I just remember thinking to myself, what have I gotten myself into?
Charity had been in trouble for much of the past decade. The open access law that guaranteed medical care for the poor did not guarantee a source of funding for that care. Starting in the late 90s, Charity endured a series of budget cuts. Dubois Blanc remembers how Charity changed over the years that he has been there.
Every year I've ever worked there, the budget has been carved up and whittled down. We're always being asked to do more and more with less and less. And I think that's probably characteristic of healthcare in general, but we were already starting with less.
The results of these funding cuts were obvious to anyone who came to the hospital for care.
The largest healthcare expenditure is salaries. So what does that mean? It means you can hire fewer nurses. And if the Joint Commission sets the standard for what the nursing ratio is, that means you're going to have to close beds. If you can't afford to hire nurses, you have to close beds. You have to close beds, that means that the waits in the emergency room are longer. Fewer patients are able to receive those services. It's a frustrating experience for both patients and doctors to have health care needs that can't be met.
Among those who Charity served is a man who would spend much of his next few years fighting for charity in the legislature.
I'm Brad Ott, and Charity saved my life. I had a stroke, and I was rushed into Charity, and they reversed really about 90% of the damage of the stroke. This was in 2003, during the beginning of the very bad budget cuts. There were $60 million that was cut from Charity Hospital System, with $30 million from New Orleans. And so there was not a bed ready for me for 2 days. And so I was in the ER. No food. Actually, they'd forgotten about us. They got too busy. You know, and then I did make it up to I made it to intensive care, which I was able to sleep finally.
After these experiences at Charity, Brad Ott went to work for the group Advocates for Louisiana Public Health Care, or ALF. But ALF lost many fights in a legislature that was becoming less and less interested in caring for the poor. The most striking change that Ott saw in those years was the gutting of the 1926 Open Access Law.
They repealed the Open Access Law that basically deemed that indigent people in Louisiana automatically got care. And so anybody who was uninsured and people who fall within 200% of the poverty line, without question, you just show your proof of income or your poverty, and that was it. And it was just a one-time thing. It wasn't. At 2003, you were still given care in emergencies, but in order to access, like, doctors in advance and stuff at clinics, you had to go through a means testing. And that means testing was going on really right up till Katrina.
But these problems would be overshadowed by what happened in the sweltering heat the last days of August 2005.
I got there at about 5:30 on Sunday, which is the normal course of events for what we call a code gray activation, as you usually show up about 12 to 24 hours before the projected strike time of the hurricane.
Renee Morrissey was part of the team to be mobilized in the event of a citywide emergency. This time, it was not a drill.
It was actually really tense because of all the activations I've been on. Only a few have actually had hurricanes, and those that did hit we were on the periphery. And this one was really promising and being the big one.
Renee Morrissey and another doctor, Michael Oudinet, were named chief residents for the event, meaning that they were responsible for the doctors and staff who would spend the next 5 days in extremely difficult conditions. However, there were some inside Charity who had been thinking about what would happen when a powerful hurricane hit, including Tim Butcher, director of emergency management at Charity, and his boss, Dr. Thomas.
Dr. Thomas sent a drill to email to everybody, telling them, clear your calendars, we're having a drill and you will participate. So he shared the concerns that Dr. Halton, our medical director, and I had about the possibilities and the consequences of a major hurricane flooding, and that helped us quite a bit because we had a lot of support from him in preparing in terms of resources and things that we needed to do before Katrina hit. In fact, most hospitals don't have a full-time emergency manager. And Dr. Thomas made sure that I had a full-time job devoted to that with Dr. Halton, the medical director, and also had a secretary full-time, and that's pretty much unheard of in most hospitals.
Butcher says that in retrospect, Charity Hospital was better prepared for the circumstance than other hospitals and government agencies.
Dr. Thomas authorized bringing in more days worth of food, more days worth of water than some of the other hospitals were able to do. And the stark contrast is if you compare our preparedness with what didn't happen in the emergency preparedness office in the city of New Orleans in the state of Louisiana in the end.
With insufficient cooperation from the government, Butcher says that at times he had to find funding in unlikely places.
If it hadn't been for some federal grants we were able to obtain from the city of New Orleans through the MMRS terrorism program, we wouldn't have been able to have some of the backup generators and some of the ventilators and satellite phones and some of the things that really came in handy during the hurricane. In fact, those were obtained from a terrorism grant. We attempted to get a planning grant from FEMA for mitigation for hurricanes, and they turned us down. So we went to the federal government through the city and applied for a terrorism grant, and we told them that, Al-Qaeda might blow up the levees. And we actually were able to sell that idea, and we used that to get the money to buy the generators and buy the satellite phones and ventilators, because there wasn't any hurricane money, but there was plenty of terrorism money around, so we kind of tapped into that.
Doctors in Charity during the flood confirmed that the portable diesel generators and pressure-activated ventilators would prove essential to saving the lives of some of the several hundred patients who would spend the next 4 days trapped there. As everyone in New Orleans will remind you, the storm itself was only the beginning. The day after Katrina passed by, Morrissey witnessed a new and more dangerous situation developing.
That was Tuesday morning. I was awoken, I don't know what time it was, maybe 5 o'clock in the morning, where the news that the hospital was flooding. We had to evacuate the entire first floor upstairs. I walked out onto our ramp, which is maybe 12 feet, 10 feet above the street level, and saw that the water had reached a halfway mark, and there was a significant sinkhole leading into the basement into which water was pouring. It was a one of those things that you might see in cartoons that you think that if you get too close to it or that you'll just get sucked in. And I remember thinking that not that the hospital was going to flood, but that the hospital would crumble, just like watching waves hit your sandcastle.
Immediately, the staff responded to the flooding.
I don't really remember this time very well, but it's been told to me that it took us only an hour and a half to move the entire first floor of Charity upstairs.
During the next 4 days, over 1,000 patients, staff, and persons seeking shelter were trapped inside the building. Morrissey says these days blended together.
Time was marked more by events than by daybreak and nightfall, by days of the week. And I find it impossible to actually recollect any kind of cogent narrative.
In those days, those trapped inside Charity would survive without many of their basic needs being met. Morrissey recounts what a trying time those days were.
It's one of these situations where just when you think it can't get worse, it always does. First you lose your primary power, then your secondary power, and then the hospital ground, it's overheating and then wiring and rewiring and blowing fuses and overpowering generators and finding patients that have, under previous circumstances, fairly routine medical problems, all of a sudden assume dire circumstances because simple things like pharmacies aren't open, or it's too late and the city has been evacuated.
Adding to the many difficulties faced by those trying to run Charity Hospital were distorted media accounts of what was going on in New Orleans. Medical Director Ben DuBois-Blanc was inside Charity and remembers hearing news on the radio that affected the decisions being made.
I think there were highs and lows in morale that were, to some extent, related to some of the misinformation being propagated over the airwaves about how dangerous New Orleans was. And we actually heard on the radio on, I believe it was Wednesday afternoon, as I was standing inside of the pharmacy on the sixth floor of Charity Hospital just chit-chatting with one of the pharmacists, we actually heard a news report that the Charity Hospital pharmacy had been attacked by a gang of armed thugs who was stealing the narcotics. And we just sort of sat there and laughed through the whole thing. But that kind of misinformation, I think, made some fear for their lives. And it clearly changed how we approached the evacuation, because we had plans to go over and use the heliport at the Superdome to evacuate our patients. But with all of these news reports of lawlessness, we decided not to take that option.
Some, like Dr. Morrissey, simply chose to ignore outside accounts.
You know about the reports that were coming from the Superdome and the convention center about rapes and marauding gangs, and regardless of whether they were true or not, they were true to us. It took all I had, all we had, to maintain a status quo. But I knew from the evacuation that trying to anticipate things was as damaging as not anticipating them, and probably more so psychologically. So I stopped listening. It was a very good decision.
Regardless of what was going on outside, de Bois Blanc says that those inside Charity were taking matters into their own hands.
Well, we were invisible to the outside world, our inability to communicate was the reason. We couldn't let the outside world know how desperately ill our patients were. And in retrospect, we waited to be rescued. And one of the lessons I learned at Katrina, it's a wonderful lesson, I'm sure I'll carry it with me everywhere I go, is that the only one you can depend on is yourself. That as soon as we quit waiting to be rescued, two things happened. One, morale improved. We had a mission. We had a focus. And two, we actually started to accomplish something.
And despite all these difficulties, Morrissey said there were very few deaths in Charity.
I'm not sure, but my estimate would be about 6. None died in the emergency room, except for one who had been pushed on life support. Other than that, no one under my direct or supervisory care died. Because the people who work at Charity at all levels are there because they choose to be there, not because it's the best paid or the prettiest hospital or the most prestigious.
When patients finally began to be evacuated from Charity towards the end of the week, many thought the end was in sight. However, Morrissey says that the evacuation that proceeded was unreliable.
They would be loaded onto an airboat and then brought to drop-off point, where at one time there may have been a secondary evacuation vehicle, but that vehicle was gone now. Or the drop-off point where the secondary evacuation vehicle was showing up, I was turning down patients. So we would load patients and they would be brought back. Or the airboats would say, would come back with reports of gunfire and say they're not taking anyone else. Or that nightfall was coming and they would stop doing evacuations.
Under these circumstances, many of the Charity staff began to fear for the safety of their patients after they were evacuated and turned over to FEMA, who did not have medical personnel on hand to deal with them.
Very early on, the evacuation craft and personnel were requiring that each patient be accompanied by a medical staff member, which you can do the numbers and see that that doesn't really work out. I remember loading her and some patients on tabletops into the back of a cavernous 18-wheeler and sending them off into the water. As it turns out, this one particular truck drove to New Orleans Airport, where the staff and the patients were offloaded onto the tarmac, to discover that there was nothing there. That initially, they were told that they had to stay with their patients, who are now separated from all the resources which had kept them functioning and alive up to this point, no longer available to them. That was the first hit that the staff took, that it was not over for them. And they were now actually in a worse situation in some respects. And then being told by a FEMA official that the staff themselves were being secondarily evacuated. But yet, no one was showing up to take care of their patients. And having staff refuse to leave, even though that's what we've been waiting for 5-6 days now.
On Friday, a full evacuation of Charity commenced. And the last of the patients and staff were pulled out.
To my knowledge, Charity Hospital was the last hospital in New Orleans to be evacuated. Because as in so many other cases, we're the last for everything. Even though in many cases, we're the first in everything. We receive attention and funds as leftovers and as emergency appropriations. Even though we deliver care to the most important population.
That afternoon, Friday, September 3rd, Morrissey and two police officers closed the doors on Charity Hospital.
Willie walked into the darkened hallway towards the ER entrance and left on the, and then walked out the door. I turned around and I saw the two police officers close the doors. There were maybe 8 or 10 people still left on the ramp and a couple of airboats sitting there yelling through the racket for us to get on the boats. Most of the people on the boats being actually armed guards, and got on the airboat. Two of the senior faculty were still on the ramp, and I remember yelling across the sound of the engine to one of them that I finally cleared the rack. And it was meant to be a joke, but it was very poignant, because we put patient file folders in a rack waiting to be seen, and it's always the question, how's the rack look? Did you clear the rack? And there's a psychological victory when you clear the rack, even though you know that the rack will soon fill up again. But I remember that's the last thing I said is, Dr. W, I cleared the rack.
Those doors have not reopened since. After the storm, an engineering consulting company, the Adams Group, declared Charity inoperable. Regional Hospital Coordinator Cynthia McThurn says that a main difficulty is repairing a wiring system from the early 1940s. And although plans existed before Katrina to build a new facility, the Louisiana legislature, which recently cut $400 million from the current year's budget in a special session, is unlikely to find the money for a new building. A temporary facility called Spirit of Charity currently operates inside New Orleans' sprawling convention center. The tent hospital has limited hours and is not a trauma facility. According to McThurn, two other area hospitals are currently carrying the vastly reduced trauma load, but neither is a level one facility. This means they lack the ability to do neurosurgery, orthopedic, and general surgery any hour of the day or night, the way that Charity did. The vast majority of people that Charity served are simply no longer in New Orleans. Ben de Bois Blanc points out the contradiction in not providing public services in a city with a displaced population that city officials claim they are working to bring back.
That's the catch-22. Without schools, without healthcare infrastructure, without social structure, who would want to come back? But do you build all that infrastructure with the idea that you're going to try to attract people back to the city? Because we're not talking about chump change. We're talking for a new hospital about $1 million per bed. So if you build a 500-600-bed hospital, you're talking $600-700 million.
De Bois Blanc says that the patients who went to Charity are not seen as politically important and therefore can be easily ignored.
The people that Charity Hospital served really didn't make up anybody's constituency. They tended not to vote in the same numbers that that other people did, and they were disenfranchised. They fell between everybody's cracks.
Brad Ott feels that Katrina could be the end of a system of care for the poor that elected officials and hospital administrators do not see as a priority anymore.
It's potentially sealing the fate of Charity Hospital. There's always been forces that have wanted to take down Charity and not have Charity Hospital. Damn the patients, damn the people who normally go to it. And yet, you know, they, of course, are realizing that they also lose a part of their whole mission. Those private hospitals lost their trauma center, and by giving it the Charity Hospital originally, they saved themselves a lot of money. Now they have to reconceive that whole thing.
Ben de Bois Blanc is now working at Earl K. Long Medical Center in Baton Rouge. He says whatever form New Orleans takes now, it will not be the same without Charity. Cheeky Black lives in Houston, where she evacuated to. She says that if Charity is not rebuilt, it will be missed by the people who will not be treated the same at other facilities.
Right now, it's going to be real hard because those that didn't have insurance, you know what I'm saying?
Yo, it's me, Lisa Loving. That FSRM report stopped rather abruptly. So what are you going to do? This is live. This is the Cable Evening News. It's not what you were expecting. There's probably some people listening right now that are wondering what the heck is going on. It's the day after Christmas. It's a federal holiday. We gave our new staff the day off. All of them being volunteers, and that's the most dedicated kind of news person you're ever going to get. I hope we have on the line right now one of the most dedicated longtime Cable News volunteers ever. Michael, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, Michael.
Okay.
We are live on the phone with Michael Papadopoulos, who is one of the KABU volunteers who actually helped us create a voice for ourselves in Corvallis some years ago. Michael Papadopoulos is one of these people who actually has such an incredible grasp of the news that most people don't even ever hear. And I wanted to invite Michael on the air to get some Corvallis solidarity going with our broadcast and just talk for about 25 minutes or so about what are some of the top stories of this year. Michael, what do you think? What do you think, Michael?
Well, of course, I mean, part of the story, the important part of the story is that we've got as far as today, which where I come from is called Boxing Day.
Yes,
which means that
Michael,
we've got over all the Grinchy stuff with Christmas and what was the other? Thanksgiving, all those things which are rather commercial, and Boxing Day is not very commercial.
Oh, tell us, you know, Michael, where are you from, and tell us what Boxing Day is.
I was born in England, Manchester, England. I was born with the daily issue of the Manchester Guardian coming through the mailbox. Early morning delivery, 7 o'clock in the morning. And we read that damn thing before breakfast.
Language.
Yes. Oh, excuse me. Yes.
Those were the days, yeah. No, but Boxing Day, it's not the day. Someone was asking me today, is that the day when people take their stuff and they put it in boxes and take it back to the store because they don't want it? What is box? Tell us.
Well, that's the American way. The English way is you carry the box around. If you're kind of a public servant, like a garbage collector or a mailman or delivery person of some kind, you went back with a container for money for people who've seen you during the year and you've brought them good stuff. And they give you money, or they give you a drink, or they give you a hail, or they slam the door in your face.
I see.
That's Boxing Day.
But I thought Boxing Day had something to do with British colonialism in its original form.
Well, I don't know whether the British, whether it traveled out of England. I don't know whether the Canadians, so how they celebrate Boxing Day, but it's a different thing, isn't it?
It certainly is. So one of the things that makes Michael Papadopoulos a fascinating and almost unsung character in the KABU community is that he's the king of our listservs, the king of our news and community listservs, where he's always posting stories that people need to know, stories that people were not going to have access to otherwise. And he culls these stories from all over the world. And so that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring Michael on the air. And Michael, I'll tell you, the one story that's really haunting me today, the story that's sticking with me the most, I mean, KABU News Director, so much stuff filters through our hands in this building. We're in an information flow. But the story about George Bush, I think probably the top story of the year is all the things George Bush ever did and how the whole world continues to tremble and hope that we get it smart and get rid of him somehow in this country. But this issue of George Bush's wiretapping and even more intrusive surveillance than anybody realized in post-9/11 America, and how these, I just want to say, environmentalist people have been caught up in this dragnet and now are accused of Terrorist Act, Patriot Act crimes to the degree that a man named William C. Rogers, 40 years old, of Prescott, Arizona, my father's hometown, killed himself last Thursday night in a jail cell in Flagstaff, Arizona, where he had been incarcerated in connection with what are called eco-terror attacks in Oregon and Washington. And Michael, I just am flogging myself over this story because in the news department, we're talking about language all the time.
Uh-huh.
How do we present the news? And we bickered. We argued over the language. Were these people eco-saboteurs or were they eco-terrorists? And Michael,
people. I have an opinion about that.
Yeah, but they were people. And, you know, until they're convicted of a crime, they're just people. You know, that's the thing that gets me. And that's a mea culpa for me publicly in this moment. But go ahead, Michael.
I agree with you about that. I mean, he's a person until he's proved otherwise, to be a criminal. And that takes a court and a judge and a spirited defense if it's available. The thing that surprises me most, the thing that's most suspicious in this year of our Lord 2000 and what is it, 2005 already?
So far.
Is that he died with a plastic bag over his head.
Right.
And I say, well, number one, you know, there are rules for locking people up. Okay, you know, that's, You search them, you take away their keys, you take away their belt in case they hang themselves.
Their shoelaces.
The suspenders. What else do they take away? Well, I'm not sure. I think they leave you with your main bunch of clothes, but I'm not sure about that. But then they don't take away the plastic bag. And the reason why that rings a bell today is that plastic bags are helpful in, we've heard they were helpful in this torture process. In Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, so forth, you know, they carry people, they hood people. They don't call them plastic bags, they call them hoods, plastic hoods. And they've had more than one report of people dying of suffocation in these plastic bags. So, I'm wondering about this character. I call him a character. He was apparently a bookstore owner.
Arizona bookstore owner.
He was well respected in the community.
Yeah.
He's been alleged to have gone to a meeting. What was it called? Earth Liberation Front?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that's a proscribed organization or whether they know enough about that organization to be able to say that everything that organization do is what? Criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Eco-terrorism is the word these days?
Yeah.
So, oh, I suppose maybe they've stretched the word criminal to say that if you talk about doing something to protect the environment, then that's criminal, that's eco-terrorism, and then you come under the Patriot Act, don't you?
You know, Michael, this is so interesting, this story, because if you just read the Associated Press report, they don't bicker, they don't quibble about these details, how some of these folks, these environmentalists, were caught up in this dragnet. They don't quibble about it. They make it sound like, you know, we investigated it for 8 years. And what it says, the Associated Press, this is, the Associated Press report says, you know, Arizona bookstore owner charged in the firebombing of a government wildlife lab in Washington, committed suicide in his jail cell Thursday. This man was accused of setting fire to the Agriculture Department's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Services facility in Olympia, Washington, in 1998.
Uh-huh.
And yet, what, you know, when you look at how, you know, it's my understanding as I try to dig deeper into this, I'm not sure if he's even being accused of being on the scene there. But you wouldn't know that from this Associated Press report. And, you know, one of the things that just strikes me in the face is, first of all, I tried to set up live phoners on this issue for our news broadcast. People in the animal rights community will not come on the air right now because every single one of them is paranoid that someone's going to knock on their door and take them away, too. There's a little bit of news behind the news that no one's going to tell
you,
okay?
Well, that's part of the general news. That's one of the great things of 2005, isn't it? That
right.
That's becoming a state of mind.
And it's hard to report on things like that because it's like, what is the news? What is the news? Is the news something that's not happening? That's something that we debate in the news department, you know. It gets me. It gets me. He was accused of setting fire to the Agriculture Department's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Services. We don't even know that he was on the scene. But we do know that the federal government casts such a wide net. I mean, is it ever possible that anybody ever charged with a crime by the federal government is innocent? Is it possible?
Well, people have been getting away, so to speak. The government has brought its evidence sometimes, and the jury has not agreed. This is a matter to have beans.
Indeed. Indeed. It just gets me. And again, this issue of trying to set up a live phoner on this is a non-starter. I feel like that's a news item, but I'm not sure how to how to pursue it, Michael.
Yeah. Well, what about telling the world, you know, that I don't know if it's going to be boring, but sooner or later you have to remind people what a person's entitled to when he does go into court. I mean, there's supposed to be a constitutional system, and they're supposed to charge you with an offense, and they're supposed to tell you what law you've offended against.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, they say, well, we've got the evidence, and we bring that evidence when the time comes. We'll give an affidavit to the judge about what you're supposed to have done. Maybe we've even gone through a grand jury, and we've tried to persuade the grand jury that you've committed an offense and that they should bring the charge.
But it's
a whole process, isn't there?
It's also the guy's been convicted in the media, and I feel like even in my own department, we sort of, I just feel like a mea culpa on this one. I feel like we missed the point, and I don't mean to out on my other wonderful volunteers who are there. And I shouldn't spend this whole segment talking about this one story. I'm Lisa Loving. I'm the Cable Evening News Director. We're live on the phone with Michael Papadopoulos, who is sort of a news guru, one of our extended community of Cable volunteers, phoning in from Corvallis. We're just going to talk a little bit live here on the news, just something different, right, about what are the top stories. Go ahead, Michael. Let's just move on with the list.
Well, you know, the biggest story, of course, is the state of the country with regard to the president's assumption of powers that don't belong in the Constitution. What was it? Was it last week where the New York Times admitted that they'd been sitting on a story about domestic spying for
a year?
Year?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we knew about that story. I mean, but could we get up and say this is what they do? The answer is that this organization and that organization and the other says that doesn't happen in America. There's a constitution to prevent it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where do we go from there? In the end, what does it take for the New York Times to get enough guts, backbone, to actually publish a story? Well, the story was going to come out because the reporter who prepared the story is going to write a book, publish a book in, what, a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and the New York Times said, oh, we'd better break the story first in case we look bad.
You know, Michael, it's so funny about the New York Times because actually, I mean, I read it when I can. I don't read it every day, but there's so many interesting stories in there, and yet they, the New York Times itself, has been one of the top stories this year. People looking at how they do what they do and what they don't do has been fascinating.
And what they don't do, well, what do you rely on the New York Times from? I mean, I'll tell you what I rely on the New York Times from. If I want to know something that's going down in Fifth Avenue or the Bronx even, or even adjacent New Jersey, or even adjacent Long Island, you know, I'd be happy to rely on the New York Times.
I don't know. I to be fair, I see interesting and good stories in there every time I pick it up. And a lot of them are the cultural coverage or the international coverage. And, I mean, they still do break stories that other people don't have, even though they've been sitting on them for a year. It's like, can't live with them, can't live without them. It just makes me wonder. And when you pick up our daily newspaper in the Portland area, the Oregonian, half of their front page comes from the New York Times, which is enough to give one pause, I would say.
Well, if you're saying that New York Times is the best you've got, well, I don't think so, because things have changed. It may have been true about 5 years ago or even 10 years ago, but we've got the Internet now.
Michael, where do you go for information?
Where I go, I've got a beat, a route. I but mostly go to the French press and the English press, because I don't read German that well and I don't read any other language that well. The rest comes in translations.
Mm-hmm.
So Agence France Presse, the English Reuters, the Guardian. There's even a decent news service that's put out by what used to be called Cable and Wireless. It used to be the old telegraph company that built cable across the transatlantic cable and, you know, telegrams. Western Union, the English end of Western Union. But they've got a whole web page on news.
Okay, so
they pick out.
I want to pick out a couple stories that freaked me out this year. I mean, as someone was pointing out, a year ago we were freaking out because of this gigantic tsunami that hit parts of Asia, and it was shocking. It was shocking. But I don't think that any of us realized that something like that was going to hit our own continent and that we were going to be just as disorganized in terms of helping people out. And so Hurricane Katrina, to me, that was a huge wake-up call, especially for race. Racial issues. We just heard Free Speech Radio News' coverage of poverty, basically, and how the most important charity hospital in the nation has been closed, probably for good in that zone. You know, Hurricane Katrina, it did freak me out. Walmart, this has been a really good year for insurgency. I'm going to use that term, insurgency against Walmart. We've had a lot of phoners, a lot of stories about local communities that are banding together basically to prevent Walmarts from taking over their communities with their giant traffic issues. Another interesting story, intelligent design, right? Which is just like this court case around whether intelligent design should be taught in the classrooms. It was just like a replay of this old Broadway show called Inherit the Wind, which kind of freaks me out to think about that. And Tookie Williams' story, man. Tookie Williams, you know, the so-called, originator of the Crips gang. And, you know, we only had so many stories on that on the KBOO News because Free Speech Radio News covered that like a blanket. And when they first started running stories, we looked at each other in the newsroom and went, okay, we'll go with this. You know, they kept covering it. By the time the federal government killed Tookie Williams, It was still kind of a shock. It was a cold shock, you know, that here's someone who actually did, it looks like, turn his life around That wasn't good enough. They wanted him to admit that he had done something wrong, right? If he had come out and admitted that he had really murdered those people in that lawsuit, they probably wouldn't have put him to death, but they did. In fact, Schwarzenegger did, the Terminator. That's the part that really freaks me out. Okay, your turn, Michael.
Well, my turn. You know, the one thread that you'll see, it's a 5-year-old thread, 4-year-old thread, is the idea that in this country, government is to be shrunk. You've had this strong Republican dirge which says too much government is bad. Let's cut down government. Let's stop raising taxes to pay for civil servants. Let's stop raising taxes altogether. Let's cut taxes. Let's reward the rich for being rich. And what's left of government is the difficult part. They're supposed to make the roads, and they're supposed to run the civil order, and they're supposed to keep your food pure, and they're supposed to maintain standards, but here and there and everywhere, those standards are being marginalized, and at the same time, they're cutting government down to, and they say, to size, and as a result, they can't manage to even begin to support the problem of a place like Katrina.
Yeah.
And you know, that was a disgusting thing. You know, the poor nations that had their tsunami, they had their big disasters. You probably had more help to the tsunami disaster areas than you did in Katrina. You didn't, I think, have people being stopped by guns from escaping over the river into the white county. Is that right?
If you just tuned in, yes, this is the KBOO Evening News. It's not what you expect. I'm Lisa Loving. I'm the Evening News Director. I'm talking live on the phone with Michael Papadopoulos, our top KBOO volunteer down in the Corvallis area. We're trying to just logic our way through some of the top stories of the year 2005. And, you know, it's interesting what you said, Michael, about, you know, the government's trying to shrink itself, so-called. I mean, I don't think it's really trying to shrink itself. I think that these super rich people are basically figuring out how they can maximize their profit, really the size of government. That's just a cover. And one of the interesting stories about this I thought that was good that came out of the New York Times this year was they did an analysis where they coined a phrase called the hyper-rich and how George Bush's tax cuts have actually created a whole new social strata that had not existed before, except maybe 100 years ago. They're comparing it to the robber baron age. But that was a story that I thought was really insightful by the New York Times, looking at these groups of people that are hyper-rich, and that didn't exist before the Bush tax cuts.
Yeah, well, you know, these people started being cut back when they invented income tax, and that means 100 years or so, maybe less than that. But the point is that 200 years ago, you had the filthy rich. And we go back to Europe, and we had the kings and the royalty and everything else, and nobody ever thought of taxing them. And that's where I link back to the idea that what they're trying to return to is to the days of slavery, work slavery, if you like, lack of freedom of speech, lack of rights. In other words, I'm just going to remind you all that civil rights started being created with the two revolutions, the American revolutions and the French Revolution. And don't use the word revolution on my program, madam, because that turns me into a commie or something.
Yeah, if you hear any clicking on the phone line, you know what's going on with that.
And that's it, and that's the other side of government. Here we are as a result of opening our mouths, we get spied on. And who does that? Well, is it people or is it machinery? Well, it's been machinery for 20 years. They've been spying on every phone call and every
email.
In the United States and in Canada and in New Zealand and Australia, there was a process called Echelon, or rather a whole lot of equipment, big antennas called Echelon, all over the place. You see a picture of them in Yakima. Yakima was the nearest one which picked up your phone calls.
You know, it's so funny, too, because actually when I saw that story come down last week about, you know, the federal government has admitted that it's been spying on people with unauthorized phone taps and stuff beyond the scope of what anyone thought was ever going to be allowed. Honestly, Michael, my first thought was, I thought we already knew that.
Yeah, well, that's what I said, too.
Right, that's what you're
saying. But, of course, we only used it, it was originated so that they could listen to the Russians, the Soviets, talking as they wandered around from their locked-up embassies in Washington, D.C.
First they came for the Russians, and no one spoke out. Michael, what are some of the juiciest conspiracy stories of the year? I mean, I like a few good conspiracy stories. I feel like the issues around 9/11. I'm not sure if any more information has been uncovered on that, although I wish that there was. But what are some good conspiracy stories?
Well, I don't know what the answer is to that, and I'm not sure what you mean by juicy, but certainly I'll raise my eyebrows every time they do talk about 9/11, and I think we're entitled to have answers. You know, there are juicy people and there are unjuicy people raising questions, and I say, not all those questions are so stupid that we can't answer them. The one that I like thinking about is, what was it that was so hot that it melted the steel framework in those buildings? You know, we even had a fellow on last week, a couple of fellows on cable, talking about that. You cannot, with a burning kerosene, burning fuel from an airplane, generate enough heat to start melting steel.
Yeah, to me, this issue, people on cable will fight tooth and nail over what happened with Building 7 of the World Trade Center, what happened on 9/11. And to me, I mean, I'm not sure what all the answers are, but I know that it speaks to the deep sense that we have that our government is basically like a criminal syndicate. And we really wish that we could control our government in the world, and we struggle to do it. We're really sort of not capable of controlling our own government. And you know, to me, that's what it all comes down to. And it's funny because I was listening to like a thumbnail obituary of Jack Anderson. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was a kid, Jack Anderson was a really big deal. He was an investigative reporter in the newspapers and maybe on TV too. And you just don't hear that much about investigative reporters anymore. Although there's still plenty of them out there. And the obituary that I heard was like, you know, that the federal government and the mafia, and this was on National Public Radio, the federal government and the mafia had conspired to try to, what, bomb him or murder him in some way, take him out of commission. And that was just delivered in sort of a offhand, deadpan, you know, casual remarks. And
well, he was on Edgar Hoover's list, you know?
Right. And it's like when we look at secret government, we look at, you know, the ways of government. This is probably, to me, the biggest story of the year. All the things that our government does that are just exactly like organized crime, and possibly that are even in cooperation with organized crime. I mean, our federal government has a long history with the mob. And it's just, you know, these issues don't go away. And I don't know what happened on 9/11, but I sometimes want to honor the people that are fighting tooth and nail about it. You know, I don't know.
Well, I'm not ready to put them down. I'm not ready to write them off. And that's where I complain very often about some of the commentators on the anti-president side of things. We've got commentator A and commentator B says, oh, it's just rubbish, this business of a conspiracy at 9/11. Just accept it. It happened. And go from there. I don't know. But some of us are still wondering about the Kennedy assassination.
I always go back to the Degrassi Knoll, you know.
Yeah.
And there's so many reasons why. So many, now there's the perfect example of, if you know, conspiracy, what does that even mean? Secret government policies to hurt people for power. You know what I'm saying? And when you look at that, what's even known on the record is now so ho-hum about Kennedy, his family, the role they played. And in a way, that also is like a segue over to what the heck is going on with the Democratic Party. You know, we all sit around waiting for them, you know, what's going on. And, Michael, something that I noticed this year was that somehow, this year, it was like a fog of a miasma that came from a swamp. Suddenly, everybody just takes it for granted that the Republicans cheated during the Democratic, during the Ohio recount.
Uh-huh.
Suddenly, I don't know what happened, but I remember being on this issue a year ago or so during the recount, and all the liberal people, a lot of cable people even, were saying, nope, show me the proof. And I, the people at the Ohio Free Press came out with proof. There were people who had facts in hand all this time, but somehow it just sort of morphed into a realization, and you never heard people say, you know, I saw this proof, and it made me change my mind. But somehow now people just take it for granted.
Yes, well, we had proof from Greg Palast 4 years ago, and we've had, proof. I don't know. Proof. Proof to what standard? Is proof the standard that we want in the courtroom?
Yeah, I think that would be a start. You know what I mean? a start, you know, courtroom style. And actually, in Ohio, there's so much weird corruption going on down there in that state. It fascinates me how all the ripples just end seemingly at the borders of the state. These issues of government corruption, too, I think that is another huge issue that we're looking at. Although, I think that even the best media fails to really go for it. If Jack Anderson were still on his beat right now, I mean, I think that we could be looking at these issues of Bush administration corruption, issues of Democratic Party corruption, too. They would just be blown open.
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether Jack Anderson would or wouldn't. I mean, somebody might. But remember, where it's happening is on the Internet. And the main thing is to have the make sure that the stuff that's on the Internet is credible.
Right.
And credible enough to influence people that can make a difference, maybe. And I've got a comment here. You talk about the Democrats. You know the people who are going to save you immediately right now against the Patriot Act or against the drilling in Alaska or whatever it is? There are a few good Republicans. And I put the word good in there with quotation marks because...
I hear you, though.
Hmm?
I hear you with that. I think there's a couple of these interesting Republican people. I don't want to have a blanket disregard of all conservatism. I mean, anymore I'm starting to reminisce about the good old days of conservatism where you knew where the conservatives were coming from. Instead of this massive insider trading, Jack Abramoff, everybody is going to steal money. It seems like the Republican Party is showing its cracks right now.
So it has to do, you know, in my book, it has to do with the presence or the absence of moral standards, which is why you can divide a few Republicans from the rest, and you can divide a few of the mainstream Democrats from the rest. But do you see, even today, they, again, I put quotation marks in, they're complaining because somebody, an anti-war candidate, is proposing to run against Joe Lieberman in the East Coast. You remember Joe Lieberman?
He's like the Republican-only Jewish member of Congress, except he's a Democrat.
Something like that, yes. But, you know, you take an issue and he's not on my side.
No, on virtually none. And yet it's, again, I mean, it seems like I'm kind of heartened by, it looks like that there is a tide turning maybe against the Bush administration it, in Congress, in the courts, in a variety of settings. And it makes me wonder, you know, if we could somehow... we the people capitalize on that, because I really don't think that a majority of people in this country elected that dude or supports what he's done to the planet.
Right. It's a bit like the advertiser says, you know, you repeat an advertisement often enough and people will believe it. And I think we're managing to do that. We're repeating to make a decent presentation that the man lied. Which man? Well, two or three of them. They lied.
It's true. Hey, Michael, we're coming to the end of this hour, and we got to cash this out. And we're
okay,
going to make way.
Cash it out.
Yeah, we're going to make way for Labor Radio.
Let's hear the money ring. If you haven't subscribed to KABU, subscribe now.
It's a deal. All right.
Take care.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
And bah humbug.
Okay, bye-bye. And this is the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Labor Radio. A little something different for the holidays. And look for a revamping of the Evening News broadcast in the coming year. It's 5:58, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Parece que eu sou uma santa ingrata. Com tudo quase nada que sai no tapa. E nem naquela água, naquela capieira. Eu vou me embora pra ladeira.
Yo con caribales.
No me metí en ese DDC. Un minuto que está sobre un reposé.